Hi.
How are you doing?
Doing great. How are you?
I'm doing great as well. Just hanging out in this kind of sweaty pizone right now.
It's a little bit sweaty in here in the pizone. It's a hot, fresh out of the oven pizone.
It is. You know what? And that's the best pizones. I still don't know if I've had a pizone.
Well, some people prefer it when their pizone has been out and cooled down a little bit. You know, like pizone in the morning is, some say, better than fresh pizone out of the oven.
How many pizzones have you had?
I think I've had one pizzone when I was a child. I don't think they're around anymore.
I think they are.
Okay.
Because I feel like I recently thought, like, I need to eat a pizzone.
Yeah. Well, if they are back, they are back, and they weren't always around. Because I feel like they were a limited time thing when I was a kid. And I remember eating a pizzone in North Carolina with my family, with my brothers and my mom. And then they disappeared from existence. And now I guess they're back. But for those that don't know, the pizzone is the Domino's
Pizza Hut
equivalent.
It's real pizza. It's not Domino's.
Equivalent of like a calzone, which is a big like loaf of bread filled with cheese, and it's amazing.
I had never heard of a calzone growing up. I had heard of pizzones a lot. Still have not had one, but if they're bringing stuff back willy-nilly now, let's get on the Bigfoot pizza.
Bigfoot pizza?
The Bigfoot pizza, or the Big New Yorker. The Bigfoot was just a giant rectangular pizza with square pizzas.
But it's otherwise a normal pizza? It's just exceedingly large?
I think it was just big and it had square pieces. But like, hey, I've always been a sucker for gimmick fast food
stuff. But you could just get two pizzas.
Well, they're round and they're in triangles.
Well, you can have them cut it into squares. Like when we were in San Francisco and you'd order Papa John's, you'd have them cut it into a square, remember?
That's right. You can do that. Well, then, okay, bring back the triple decker. Do you remember that?
No. What is that?
Do you know? Okay.
Is it literally three pizzas on top of each other?
Oh, it's better. It's better. It's one perfect pizza. And to tell you how good it was, the advertising campaign back then, I distinctly remember, was a monk who had sequestered himself in the mountains and vowed to live in silence for like 10 years or something. And so it's like, I'm not going to make a word. This is the real commercial.
Oh, it's a and world building in this commercial.
There was. I remember it 25, 30 years later. And he somehow got a triple-decker Pizza Hut delivered to his mountain hideaway. And he took a bite of the pizza and his eyes lit up and he walks out of his monastery or whatever and he stands at the top of the tallest cliff, like fucking Rocky, and screaming at Drago on top of the Russian mountains, except for he just screams. And he has to break his vow of silence because the triple decker is so amazing, and he wasn't wrong to break his vow.
They don't make commercials like they used to.
No, and back then it had to be true, and like that monk actually did that.
I think if it was true, triple decker pizzas would still be around if they were that great.
I have not gone into what the triple decker is yet. I was just building you up to its magnificence before I described it. And tell me if this doesn't sound like the most me thing that you can imagine, knowing my taste in food very, very well. It is a normal pizza.
Okay.
From Pizza Hut.
I'm on board so far.
So far, so good. It's got all the fixings, all the good stuff. You got a crust, a circular crust.
Got to have that crust.
Uh-huh. I guess the next thing is the tomato sauce.
That's right.
It's got that and a bunch of good cheese. Order it with extra cheese. It's great. Then you get whatever you want. If you want your sausages, your pepperonis, whatever you want. That's great. The key and what makes it a triple decker is that the crust is three different layers of cheese.
Instead of like a crust made of dough,
I think it might have had like a slight thing of dough on the very bottom, just so you could like put your hand on dough instead of straight into hot cheese.
It's not from dough to tomato sauce to cheese. It's dough, cheese, tomato sauce, cheese.
Maybe slight dough and then cheese, cheese, cheese. Three distinct layers. Then a little hint of tomato sauce, and then extra cheese.
I doubt strongly that these were three distinct layers of cheese, and not
do you not trust Yum Brands?
Amalgam of orangey, yellowy colored goop.
We will look up the science behind the triple decker, and I promise you, it is just because you know. All I want from any of my food is just for it to be as cheesy as possible.
Yes.
I don't remember if I've told you, but I used to go to when I would get famous bowls at KFC. I would literally tell them, like in my 20s, I would say, okay, I want you to put what you think is too much cheese on it and then put another handful of cheese on it.
So would you give this order like in the drive-thru or like?
I typically did that in person.
And did it often cause confusion?
No, and I was always like, I had a tone of like, it wasn't a demand. It was like, hey, this is going to sound weird, but if it's okay, you know, it was always like, I know I'm being kind of silly with it, but also I fucking want it.
And if you screw this up, you're done for.
Oh, police are dragging me out of the KFC if they screw up.
So would they charge you extra?
You usually get the one extra cheese charge when you do my type of cheese order. But most places are only equipped to do one extra cheese charge. So you can tell them whatever kind of comical amount of cheese you want on it.
It will just be grouped into the one extra umbrella.
49 cents, 79 cents. You know, you go on the Taco Bell app, I mean, you get extra cheese, that's it. But then in notes, you could be like, no, fucking go nuts.
Right, okay.
And they're not going to double charge.
I actually usually tell them light on the cheese when I would get a pizza.
I say light on everything but cheese. Just give me cheese in a bag. I don't want the tortilla chips. Just give me the nacho cheese sauce.
Do you know that you could like have cheese whenever you want? It's not like this crazy thing that you only get when you get pizza.
Well, you've seen how I eat. I mean, I'm constantly eating string cheese and those little like Sargento balance break things that you get.
Yeah.
And just load it up. You, if there's a box of Cheez-Its in the house, it's just going
to
be inhaled.
Yeah, we have to not keep Cheez-Its around because you will eat them all quickly.
I've turned Razor into a cheese aficionado.
Yes,
he loves Cheez-Its.
He knows toasty Cheez-Its.
Extra toasty Cheez-Its, yes. Cheez-Its, what a great company. Are they a company or are they owned by like Nabisco or something?
I think
probably.
It's Nabisco.
That sounds right. They're like Cracker
Maybe
people,
right? Maybe it's Mondelez.
Mondelez?
Yeah.
Like Lay's potato chips?
No, Mondelez.
Is that a separate thing, or does Mondelez make Lay's?
Lay's is separate. That's L-A-Y-S.
What the hell is Mondelez?
Mondelez is L-E-Z at the end. I think it's what Nabisco turned into. Now Nabisco's owned by Mondelez.
Aren't they the people that like put crazy seeds in farms and everyone
You're
gets mad at?
You're thinking of Monsanto.
That's the one. Different company?
Different company.
Okay,
yeah.
Different thing.
Completely okay. Different thing.
Gotcha.
I mean, both are making weird science foods.
They're playing God with delicious food, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, what do you like to eat?
I eat a lot of roasted broccoli.
Yeah? Sweet.
And eggs.
Yeah?
Gotta love a good egg. I got this Everything Bagel seasoning. Have you ever seen this stuff? I have it in the house.
No, but I would try it.
It's literally the seasoning that's on an Everything Bagel. It's just in a jar that you could put on stuff.
That sounds great because I love Everything Bagels.
Yeah. It's got the salt, poppy seeds, onions, like all that fun stuff. Sesame seeds.
Really?
Anyway, hard boil an egg. And then, you know, don't overboil it. Do like 7 minutes, 6 minutes, 7 minutes.
I would not know the first step on hard boiling an egg.
Then you just douse it in Everything Bagel seasoning. Oof.
I would try
it's
that.
Good shit.
If you could make that or teach me how to make that, I would try it.
You literally just put an
hang
egg
on, hang on, wait, don't tell me. I'm going to try to guess.
Okay.
If I, do we, okay, just answer yes or no questions. Don't spoil it for me.
I won't.
Do we have everything in this apartment currently to make a hard-boiled egg?
Yes.
Okay. Is there more to it than just an egg?
No.
Okay, so literally a pot, some water, and an egg, and I can do this.
Yeah, you don't even have to crack the egg.
Okay. Oh.
You don't want to crack the egg.
Okay. So I would guess I'm going to take one of those circular pans. Doesn't have to be a huge one if I'm just making one hard-boiled egg.
Right.
I fill it with water, maybe halfway, maybe a little more than halfway.
You just want to be able to submerge the egg.
Okay.
Might be halfway. It might be a little less than halfway.
I'll say my whole thing and you tell me the spots where I screwed up.
Okay.
Okay. I'm going to say I'm going to fill it to maybe the 60 to 70% line with water in the pot. I'm going to put the pot on the stove. I have still never used our stove, and that's a whole separate thing, trying to figure out how that works. Then I press a button to make... Hey, I doubt my dad knows how to use his stove, and he's lived there for 10-plus years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
proceed.
You put it on the stove. I would Google how to make the fire happen. Do we have one of the fire stoves, or do we have the...
You really don't know how to use the stove?
I mean, I could figure it out, I'm sure, but I've never used it. And it always scares me.
It's the same as every stove you've ever had in your life.
Yeah, but a lot of stoves... Well, first of all, I don't use my stove barely ever. But then some of them have the thing where you turn it, and you have to turn it to the crazy setting where it's like, tick, 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 and then an explosion happens in your face. You don't have eyebrows anymore.
No.
So
you're getting a lot of these steps wrong, by the way.
Okay, well, you can fill me in afterwards. So I'm going to put it on maybe medium heat, and then I'm going to put the pot with the 60 to 70% water on top of the heat there on the fire one. There's four of them, and I'm going to pick the one bottom left.
The one that you turned
close
on?
To me.
Yeah.
That one. That's the one. See, I know I'm right about that. I'm going to put it there, and then I'm going to take an egg right out of the fridge as it comes from the grocery store in that state. And then, I mean, whatever the default egg state is, like when it comes like out of it doesn't change states when it goes from the chicken's butt to the grocery store.
Why do you keep calling it states?
Well, because that's one of the confusing things about eggs is there's 9,000 states to it.
No, it's
yes.
Just...
Okay. Look, I know there's like raw, hard boiled.
There's different preparations, but different states.
You could poach, you can scramble, you can... I still don't know what the fuck a sunny side up or any of that stuff is.
There are different preparations.
I only had scrambled, and then we had the poached one in New Orleans. No, scotch egg. I had a scotch egg.
That was amazing.
Okay, that was good. I've had omelets. I don't know if those are scrambled, technically. Are omelets scrambled?
I think they would probably be... all like closest to scrambled eggs, because a lot of times if you get scrambled eggs at a diner, they'll present it to you like an omelet.
Okay.
I think a lot of people just consider scrambled eggs to be just like whisking it so that the yolk breaks and mixes with the whites, so it's just kind of like one yellow thing.
Got it.
For some people, for me, I think of scrambled eggs as like kind of like little pieces, kind of creamy, and you know, like very soft and creamy and little.
Okay.
Bits.
The way you make it is great.
Yeah, I'm glad you make
excellent.
It that way.
It's very good. Still have not tried like an over easy or sunny side up or flippy floppy, whatever. But anyway, back to the hard boiled.
Okay.
All right. We've covered the water. We've
so
covered the fire.
You got the water and yes. on the fire.
And then I'm going to take it in the default state as it comes out of the carton, which I think is the same as raw. So I think I'm taking a raw egg.
Yes.
And I'm gently, like I'll probably take it between my thumb and my middle finger on either end and not squeeze so as not to break it. And I would... not drop it in, but I would rest it on the top, the cusp of the water, and I would gently let it go. So I wonder if an egg floats, because I wonder if it would drop to the bottom and break. It would probably float. So I'm going to let it float and just kind of rotate around. And if it doesn't hit all the corners, if it doesn't hit all the sides, I would like put my hand in and kind of spin it. So it's like, you know, when you open up the microwave and you spin it around. And okay. So I would rotate it to make sure all the sides are getting hit. I would leave it. Egg timers are a very specific thing, so I bet it is a very specific amount of time. I think egg timers are like 3 minutes. So I would leave it in there for 3 minutes, making sure to kind of spin it every once in a while, and then afterwards I would take it out, and then I'd do the thing where you crack it on the counter, because I've seen Ben Hansen try to do that to horrible effect, and then that would give it enough of a little crack, and I would peel the shell off of it, and I would eat it.
Okay.
Good. Let me know. Was that good?
All right. No.
Okay.
Okay, so... You want to just, this is how I do it at least, okay? You take the egg just right from the fridge and put it in the pot.
From the carton.
Yes.
Raw.
Yes, and then you just run it underwater, and then you put it on the stove, and if you wait till, once the water's boiling, you know, I usually do it from like, I don't know, once the water starts boiling, maybe like 3 minutes after that, because then it's had time to sit in the water as it's getting hotter. Or what I will do is I'll use our, we have an electric kettle, because that boils water really fast, so I'll boil it there.
And wait, you just... put the egg in the tea kettle?
No, I put the egg in a pot.
Oh, you
I'll
boil
the water separately.
Got it.
And then
it
just pour it right over so it's really hot. And then I still turn on the flame on the stove
got
to
it.
Just keep the
maintain
boil.
It.
Exactly. You don't want to boil it for just 3 minutes, because if you're doing cold water with an egg in there for 3 minutes, the water's not going to be boiling. That egg will be pretty much raw.
What does an egg timer count then?
I don't use an egg timer. I just use a regular timer on the stove, because I know that if I put an egg in boiling water and keep it boiling for like 6 minutes, it'll be like perfectly how I like it, kind
six
of
soft minutes?
Boils.
And that's
soft
what you
boil.
Do with no variance. Like you're not sticking in like a meat thermometer to make sure the yolk's at the right temperature or anything.
No, I mean, you know, the yolk could be runny. If you like it soft boiled, you just cook it for less.
Do yolks, if they're not cooked right, do like a salmonella chicken thing?
I mean, yeah, they could, but you're still exposing it to enough heat that I think, you know, they're safe if you have a runny yolk. I mean,
because well, Rocky just ate them raw. I know it's not like... the safest
I mean,
thing.
You're
but...
not like supposed to eat raw eggs. You're not supposed to eat raw cookie dough. You know what I mean? Like you
right.
could get sick. There's a chance there.
But you're probably fine, right?
Yeah. And if your egg is floating on top of the water, that means your egg is bad. You don't want to eat an egg that floats.
Oh, it's like rotten already?
If an egg floats on top of the water, that means it's rotten. You do not want to eat that egg.
Oh, that was okay.
Yeah. And, you know, you're not dropping it from a high height. So, you, like I said, I put the egg in the pan, in the pot before I put water in there. But
right,
if you're
right.
putting it in the water, like it'll fall slowly. It's not going to.
Okay, it doesn't, like, shatter.
No, it'll be fine.
Okay.
And then, yeah, cracking it or taking the peel off isn't as easy as just rolling it around and then peeling it off. Like, I take a spoon and I crack it a little bit, and then I just put the tablespoon under it just to get all of the shell, and then I just go around like that, and then the shell usually come off really easily.
Is this an easy thing to show me sometime?
It's so easy.
I would be curious to see this, and then I would eat it afterwards with the everything bagel seasoning.
It's... arguably the easiest egg preparation. It's not my favorite simply because if I'm making eggs, I just want to make them quickly. It's not the quickest, but it is the easiest.
Okay.
Because it's like very hands-off.
Quick question. Sorry to belabor this. Mm-hmm. But so if you eat an egg raw, or cookie dough raw, not recommended, but you're fine. Is that the same thing like if you just grabbed a raw chicken breast and ate it?
No, don't.
Would that
ever
definitely get you sick? I'm not saying I'm going to. I'm just saying hypothetically.
I think there's a much stronger likelihood that raw chicken will get you sick. That's why, like, I try not to handle the chicken directly. If I do have to touch a chicken, I then scrub my hands like crazy and stuff.
Okay.
You always want to cook chicken completely. You don't want to eat any chicken that has raw pink in it.
I think chicken's what screwed me up with cooking overall is because you would hear all that stuff. Everything mm-hmm. you're saying now, you would always hear about like, oh, you know, don't handle it with your hands, don't do this, and make sure it's cooked all the way through. And so once I heard that at a young age, I think I just assumed that cooking or preparing anything that wasn't like a peanut butter sandwich, if you did it wrong, you were going to, it was deadly poison and you were going to die. And so I was always terrified to cook anything.
No, I mean, there's ways, like if you're new to cooking chicken, you could use a meat thermometer. If you're worried, you could just cut it in half just to make sure that it's cooked the way through. I've cooked chicken so much at this point for you that like I could tell that it's done just by like how much it bounces back.
You know what I mean? You make chicken great.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. But so you don't want to eat raw poultry. Hard-boiled eggs are really easy to make, or boiled eggs are really easy to make. I feel like you can't really overboil it if you just like boil it and then leave it in there, shut the water off. I mean, the yolk will just be totally firm, like not firm, but it won't be runny at all.
Okay. Let's check it out. Thank you so much. You teach me things every day, and I appreciate it. Genuinely do.
Yeah, hard-boiled eggs are a great snack because they're not messy. They're like just 70 calories, protein. Oh. And I think they're tasty, but, you know, you have to like the taste of eggs, of course. But
teach me how to do that, because, like, honestly, that sounds like I would love to have, like, a healthy snack option other than just, like, cheese. Mm-hmm. That I'm not saying cheese is healthy, but I'm saying, like, that's the thing I just grab when I'm snacking.
Yeah, I mean, cheese in moderation isn't an unhealthy snack.
I don't want cheese in moderation.
Well, you're having this string cheese. It's not.
It's true. It's not crazy, but like
2 string cheeses a day isn't going to hurt you, Dan.
It's true, but in my mind, I don't want to be moderate with cheese at all. Aguirre, the Wrath of God.
That's right,
by Werner Herzog. That is
the landmark piece of cinema.
Yes.
By your best friend, Werner Herzog.
Close, personal friend, Werner Herzog. Yes, I got to meet him at a Simpsons table read with, I believe it was Alex Navarro, a former coworker of mine. I think it was Ben Hansen and Ben Pack. That's right. I met him with him. He was great. What a good friend. Just hit the bars up in L.A. all night, just telling us all sorts of stories. He was just he was a blast. Mm. So old Vern. Yes, he made this. And
so what other Werner Herzog movies have you seen? Have you seen
Grizzly
any of
Man?
Yeah, that's a great movie.
And Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans.
If you had the opportunity to listen to that final Grizzly Man audio, the one that Werner Herzog listens to in the documentary, would you take that opportunity?
Or? No, I know some people, a lot of people, and you used to be like this, kind of that morbid curiosity. Mm. I don't have that. I'm just not, you know, if I know that there's like... Like, I remember when I was a kid, there was a tabloid that, like, infamously, like, published a bunch of, like, the O.J. Simpson crime scene photos mm-hmm. and stuff like that. I remember everybody was talking about it and looking at it, and I was like, I'm good. I don't need to see that.
You know, it's weird when this is a really weird reasoning. It isn't even reasoning. It's completely illogical. But for some reason, if it's, like, a famous crime, like a well-known crime, like the LeBlanc, you know, LaBianca murders or, you know, Columbine or whatever, like, really famous crimes... And there are crime scene photos. Like, I don't feel as weird looking at those as I do, like, looking at, like, just, like, a random murder or something like that. Because I don't know, maybe it's because it's, like, well, so many people have seen this. It's, like, out in the open. It's like, known. And
whereas if it's, like, a random person, it's, like, you just, like, stumbled across a body and you weren't supposed to see it.
Yeah. But also now, that morbid curiosity that I used to have, I really don't have it anymore. In fact, I make a concerted effort to not see any gore stuff because I just... You know, I just don't get anything from it. It makes me uncomfortable. It was a person, you know what I mean?
Right.
That being said, I love true crime stuff. But,
yes. You're a fiend for that.
I am a fiend for that. But, okay, so Grizzly Man, I love that one. Did you see Into the Abyss?
No, I remember you watched that when I was out of town time, and you liked it a lot.
Oh my gosh, that was an incredible movie.
I remember you were big on that one, yeah.
Yeah, he's, Werner Herzog, man, he had a role in that documentary, like, you could hear him kind of interviewing, but it was such a light touch, and even though it was on, like, kind of centered around a rather polarizing subject, which it really wasn't really the focus of the movie, it was the death penalty, but it was kind of framed around it, or, you know, executions or whatever. He didn't really have a heavy hand or show his opinion or whatever. It was more about how arbitrary death is, and, you know, just the senselessness of death and killing and stuff. And it's an incredible documentary. If you're listening to it and haven't seen it, I strongly recommend it.
He always seems to, like, view things through a very analytical, philosophical lens, the way I just heard him talk. Like, I haven't seen a lot of his movies, but just to hear him describe things, like, I could see what you're saying with Into the Abyss. Mm-hmm. Or even, you know, he's described going to WrestleMania several times. And, like,
that's really?
There's...
Is he a wrestling fan?
He's going to WrestleMania. I'll send you a link of, like, all the times he's talked about it. It's pretty interesting. Like, I think he just is fascinated by just about anything, whether it's nature or art and culture or humanity and death and things like that. I think he's just a very inquisitive guy from everything I've seen. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it seems like just looking at his filmography and everything, it's not like, you know, there's some directors where it's like, oh, that's a Michael Bay movie, that's his thing. Like, I feel like all of Werner Herzog's stuff, even just by description, is like, these seem like completely different types of things.
But they're all handled with a mastery, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I'll say right off the bat, I thought this was a cool movie.
Oh, it was awesome.
Aguirre, The Wrath of God.
And I didn't know what to expect because, you know, when I heard you recommend this movie, that we watch it for the podcast, I was confused because I thought it was the documentary about his relationship with the actor who plays Aguirre in the movie.
Klaus Kinski.
That's actually this other documentary that he made called My Best Fiend.
Yeah, yeah, because they had like a tumultuous, like extreme, like basically Klaus Kinski was an insane person and incredibly difficult to work with. So, but
yes.
Herzog like kind of loved working with
him. In a lovable way.
I don't know about that. I think he was brought an intensity to his roles from what I read about him that Herzog found interesting.
So I didn't, that's all I just said. I didn't know what this movie was about.
I knew nothing about it. I think I'd heard Alex Navarro mention it to me. I saw the art for it on, by the way, it's on the Criterion channel. That's where we watch it. It is also on Amazon Prime Video, if you'd like to check it out. And the art for it, not art, but you know, the poster, is a dude with a helmet and a sword. And I feel like I've seen a million movies with like helmet, sword, armor, castle type things. Mm-hmm. And if you told me that was anywhere between like 5,000 BC and 1800, I'd be like, yeah, I guess that's when castles and that type of war happened. Like, I've heard terms, like, I know, like, the Crusades and the Spanish Inquisition, I've heard those things referenced. I don't know if that happened 5,000 years ago or 300 years ago. I don't know if that's the Renaissance or medieval or Dark Ages. I really just have no idea. I don't know what those things are. Mm-hmm. So it could have been any of those things. Is this the Spanish Inquisition? Is that what this movie's about?
It's Spanish trek into the Amazon to look for El Dorado, and he's a conquistador. Yeah.
So that's what it was the Spanish looking for gold and stuff?
Well, looking to, I guess, expand their territory, right? I mean, like, the Spaniards were, back in the day, I mean, they were conquering the Incan Empire. They were conquering stuff left and right. I mean, wasn't Amerigo Vespucci a Spaniard?
I know, like, yeah, because that's like the only history I kind of know is like basic American stuff. And
yeah.
Like Amerigo Vespucci came before Columbus.
Spaniards were all about exploration back in the day.
I don't think I knew that they like went around, because I know England like went around and like basically said like, oh, this island belongs to England. I didn't know Spain did that.
Yeah, Spain did that.
Okay, I don't know.
Yeah,
did
well,
like all
I,
those
England,
European countries?
I think England, you know, focused a lot on like the American colonies and stuff. And Spanish, like, you know, they... Obviously, they conquered the Incan Empire in Mexico, Panama, and all that stuff. Yeah. So, so that was the purpose of, in this movie, not talking historical accuracy, but the purpose of the expedition into the Amazon in this movie was to find the city of gold, El Dorado.
And so I've heard of that. I've heard like the legend of El Dorado, the city of gold. Was that just like a myth back then that
yes.
like explorers looked for and just it never, is it like Atlantis?
I think so. As far as I know, I think that's what it was. But I think maybe, you know, back then it wasn't necessarily easy to be like, oh, that's not true, or, you know, that's just a myth or whatever. So
right.
I'm sure maybe the less educated people kind of took it at face value and thought that the prospect of gold is real. I mean, I'll talk about it a little bit here, but in like the real life analog to this expedition was they were told to look for the city of El Dorado, but the reality is they pretty much just wanted these veterans to have something to do so they wouldn't cause trouble.
It was busy work.
Work. Yeah. So, I mean, in this movie, they're obviously earnestly making an effort to find the lost city of El Dorado. So
it seems like it's couched in like a historical time and idea, but the actual specific events were not at all like largely fictional, right?
I would say so. Yeah. I mean, the desire to, you know, have dominion over a piece of land and just arbitrarily like just take it from the natives and be like, this is mine. I mean, that's obviously a very real thing that's happened in our country and all over the world. And I think, you know, we see that a lot here.
Yeah, there's the part where they're going down the river and the, like, king guy is just like, well, the longer this boat goes, that's just more country that's mine.
Well, yeah, I mean, in the opening sequence, that fucking awesome opening sequence when they're walking up the, or walking down that hill and through the jungle, which is just the most, like, it's presented so matter-of-factly. There's no glamorization of anything in this movie. It's so matter-of-fact, and it feels like, I felt that, like, oh my gosh, this is going to sound so stupid, but, you know, I feel like how these people must have felt. I can relate to that feeling, having just been in any situation where I just want to leave and go home.
Where it's,
you know,
like,
what I mean?
This sucks.
Yeah, like, when will this be over? I just want, I mean, obviously this is a completely much more extreme situation.
Right, different scale, but.
Yeah, but it's just like, when is this going to be over? I just want to go home.
I'm just that, like, exhaustion. But, like, they're trekking up and down mountains and they're, like, wearing full armor while going through mud and, like, dealing with a horse and the river they have to cross and everything.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's it gets progressively worse, but just that beginning part when they're traveling with the full, like, several hundred natives.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, we talk about them just arbitrarily claiming land. Like, they grabbed a bunch of natives and I guess they just enslaved them.
You know what I mean? Already there, right?
Yeah. So yeah, it's a very, very kind of claustrophobic at times movie. You really feel sweaty watching it. It's really, like, you feel sweaty, you feel the humidity, like, it's so atmospheric and with very little, like, pretension at all. Like, it's just the way it's filmed, the way it's presented. It's so simply and just, like I said, it's just unpretentious.
It's just on its face. It's not like I've heard you mention several times, probably on this podcast, but also just me and you, that you don't like it when a movie is, like, doing music and stuff that's supposed to, like, tell you how to feel.
I hate that.
Yeah, right. And so, like, I feel like this super didn't do that.
Right. It should just, like, accent whatever's happening.
Yeah, like, there was that whole part here at the beginning where they send the one crew out on a raft across the river to be like, hey, let's see if we can get across there. And they get in a real bad situation. They get, like, stuck, like, going into this eddy. I don't know if that's, like, a little cove on a river, but it's a bad situation. And it's not like the music is this pounding, like, dun-dun-dun-dun, like, you know, terror, danger music. It's just, they're just showing this for a while.
Right.
And just in my head, I'm just like, this seems like a bad situation. Yeah. This seems terrible.
I love movies when, you know, and obviously, you know, I absolutely love music and I love a good soundtrack in a movie, but I really appreciate when music is used sparsely. Either not used at all, like No Country for Old Men, or used sparsely so that when it does happen, it's so impactful.
Yeah.
I recently saw A Portrait of a Lady on Fire, and that did that, where the music, it didn't itself have a soundtrack, and there was music in one part, but it was from, like, what was going on, like, there was a band
Diegetic.
Performing. Okay, yeah, that's what it was.
That's something I remember from film school.
So, yeah, and then when that happened, it was just such an amazing, like, rousing feeling. It was so cool. But, yeah, I love that. I hate when things are too heavy-handed.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, I get this is the climax. You don't need this, like, pounding, you know. Like, and that can be used to great effect. You know, there are times, like, you know, John Williams, you know, can take a, you know, a Phantom Menace and, like, Duel of the Fates will happen, and that makes the Darth Maul fight just, like, super awesome. But, like, I know what you mean. Sometimes it seems too...
It seems like a crutch sometimes.
Yeah, but the way they do use it here is awesome. It's like this... It's not often, but it's like this very weird, just kind of like cosmic synthy... I don't know music enough to know how to describe it well. Is it a Moog synthesizer? Is that what we're hearing here?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay, it's just really, really cool and atmospheric.
Yeah, the soundtrack in this movie is awesome.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Let's talk a little bit about what's going on. So it's this expedition, like I said, through the Amazon to try to find El Dorado. It's led by this guy, Ursua, I think is how you pronounce the name. We're going to get the pronunciations right about this movie very wrong.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He's leading the crew. There's Aguirre, who's like this second or third in command.
He's pretty much third for most of it.
He seems pretty competent, but he seems like kind of conniving and
loose cannon
and power hungry. And yeah, it seems like he's getting people on his side in the background so that they will, you know, work for him, and that when it comes time to usurp Ursua, like, there's no resistance at all because everyone's already on his side.
And he seems like he's very much one of the, like, no matter what, we are moving forward, we are finding the city, mm-hmm. like, no matter, like, in the face of, like, obvious, like, there are so many things where, like, they should turn back, or, hey, this isn't going to work out, mm-hmm. like, our numbers are dwindling, and he just steadfast, never, ever loses sight of it. But not in, like, a good, you know, brave way, in, like, you have no idea what the fuck you're talking about here. Like, you're not realistic.
And it's not like when this was happening, I mean, the time period that this is supposed to be, it's not like you could just call someone and be like, hey, can you get me out of here?
Right.
Like, the only way to get out of the situation would be to go the way you came. And they're cutting through thick jungle, like, all the wildlife, all the Indians, the natives there that want to kill them, and, like, are, like, stealth masters and just, like, hiding in the bushes and fucking slaughtering these guys, and they don't even know. Like, all they know, it's so cool the way they do it. Whenever there's complete silence, whenever the forest, the jungle goes silent, that's how they know that there's Indians around.
Yeah, that's like, it's too quiet right now.
Yeah, it's so cool. And you don't even, like, notice it the first few times, but then you realize, like, oh, fuck, every time it's completely silent, that's when the Indians are around and
an arrow comes
die
into frame or something.
Yeah. It's really cool.
Yeah, and speaking of the raft from earlier on, I think it is the Indians that kill all the people on the raft, right? Because they all get, like, arrows and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Two of the guys escape. But Ursua the one that's kind of, like, religious? No, they've got, like, a priest guy, too.
Yeah, that's Carajal or something. We'll just call him the priest.
The priest, yeah, wants to take the body. He's like, hey, we got to take him, you know, off this land and give him a Christian burial and all this stuff. And, like, Aguirre is just so laser-focused on the gold that he's, like, he orders or implies an order of, like, hey, that cannon's getting pretty rusty to one of his dudes. Mm-hmm. And so he shoots the cannon at the raft and basically just blows up all the bodies into the water, mm-hmm. so they don't have to waste time.
Right.
So this ruthless, horrible dude,
right,
obviously.
Yeah, ruthless is a really good way to describe him.
Yeah.
But his daughter is with him on this exhibition. And it's this weird contrast because it seems like the only thing he is sensitive or gentle about in his life is his daughter, who he seems to be kind of weirdly obsessed with.
Oh, by the end.
Yeah.
Openly.
Totally. Yeah, obviously. But, like, it's hints at it in the beginning before it goes full-blown madman. But I really like the part where he finds this little tiny, oh my gosh, it's so cute, this little anteater who he describes as, like, being never quite asleep or never quite awake. And it's just this little, like, roly-poly little guy who's so cute. Oh my gosh.
And his tongue is hanging out, like, if his head is like an inch tall, the tongue is hanging out like 4 inches out the side.
Well, you know how anteaters work, right? They have those long snouts and really long tongues so they can get into, like, little ant
holes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I love anteaters.
They're great.
Yeah, I think they're cool.
We have not met any anteaters yet in Animal Crossing, but hopefully we'll run into one.
Ooh, yes.
Oh, there's anteaters there, for sure.
Very cool.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, how about that flute guy just going to town all the time?
You loved that flute guy.
I did. I was bopping my head every time he showed up.
Oh,
I was like,
you
this guy
so
just loves
into it.
He loves his flute, and he kind of sucked at it. Like, it sounded like he wasn't even, like, blowing all the way into it. I don't know how it's supposed to sound. They have one of those things in Spirit Tracks, and I've heard guys play it in, like, train stations and stuff like that. And I like the sound of it. It's a cool bouncy instrument.
Well, this one was made from, like, trees and stuff like that, so it's not gonna
it wasn't
have the,
like,
same sound as the ones you hear in train stations. I thought he was pretty good at it.
I liked his attitude.
Yeah, I really liked his attitude, and he was, like, just there to entertain. I mean, obviously, you can't just pull out your phone and play threes. Like,
yeah.
All you could do is just listen to this guy blow on his flute thing, whatever you would call it.
Yeah, during long stretches of like sitting around and waiting or like being on a raft, it's like, I would love to have that guy just, you know, playing this fun tune.
The one thing that concerned me about this movie, and it really has nothing to do with the quality of the movie, it's just some of the way they use the animals concern me. Like the horse specifically, there was a horse on the raft that like they, you know, made fall a few times, and knowing how, you know, delicate the horse legs are, like porcelain, if they break, the horse has to be killed. Like, horses can't survive with any kind of like leg injury. And, you know, he just, at one point, he just, Aguirre just throws a little monkey. And, you know, considering when this was filmed in the 70s, there probably wasn't as many, like, regulations. I doubt there was, like, a PETA person on location or anything like that. So that was a little concerning and scary for me to think about, but
yeah, I feel like in our lifetimes, we're so used to, like, no animals were harmed in the making of this. Right. But, like, back in 72 in, like, the jungle, I don't know if they had... Yeah, I'm sure they weren't trying to hurt animals, but like, yeah, I am with you where it looked a little too...
Oh, by the way, how cool and freaky was that scene where the horse... So ultimately, this horse is like annoying everyone. Mm-hmm. So against everyone's better judgment, Aguirre like insists that they leave the horse behind. Or is it the king that insists that...
Oh, the king gets annoyed by the horse.
Right, the king gets annoyed by the horse. And then they like essentially just push the horse off the boat and the horse swims to shore. And he has this, like, face mask on, like, you see, like, in medieval...
It's like a lucha mask.
Kind of like a lucha mask. Yeah, you see it in, like, when you see, like, knights jousting, the horse will have that, like, face cover on. I don't know what it's called.
Yeah.
But, so this horse is just perfectly still watching them sail along and, like, slowly disappearing behind, like, as they move through the bushes, like, it's slowly disappearing in the distance. And it's just staring at them with this fucking mask on. Can you imagine seeing, like, going through the... Amazon jungles and just seeing this weird lucha horse.
Yeah, just have no idea where it came from. The scene where they're going away on the raft, they just hold on the horse for a long time, and it is just kind of creepy to see as they pass
by. Yeah, the way they hold on it, it's really interesting. But I kind of felt bad for the horse, but I also thought, like, well, maybe the horse would fare okay in the jungle. I mean, there's so many leaves for it to eat and whatnot, and I imagine it would be prey eventually, but
yeah,
you know, there's water and leaves and an abundance of wildlife, you know, plants for it to eat. So
yeah,
it kind of kept me from getting sad about the horse.
So yeah, it's a lot of like, even in this like weird scope of just like this group going on this expedition, there's a lot of like scheming from Aguirre, where he is like, you know, he's third in command or whatever, but he basically wants to install this kind of lazy dude as the king, and then get rid of this Ursua guy who's kind of like rivals in a way with him.
Yeah.
And they kind of each have their followers and stuff. Mm-hmm. And Ursua winds up getting shot, right? And so
he doesn't die immediately.
No, he's just in a bad way and won't talk at all for like most of the movie.
Yeah,
here.
I mean, he's kind of fucked. I mean, like, yeah, there's no one's going to go against Aguirre once it's obvious that he's in power.
Right, but Aguirre wanted to have this like kind of farcical like trial and then have the king say, oh, you know, off with his head or whatever. Mm. But he grants him clemency, which seems to piss Aguirre off. Mm. And so I remember then being like, oh, he's totally going to like turn on this king too, because ultimately he's just trying to get himself in power. Mm. And he does a lot of just like intimidation stuff when he's like, hey, everyone vote on this thing and we'll just like get right in your face and stare at you with crazy eyes until you raise your hand, you know?
Yeah.
Klaus Kinski... Again, does not seem like a good dude by any stretch of the imagination. Long dead by this point. But he has a intensity to his eyes and facial expressions where it's like, oh, yeah, I believe that this guy's nuts.
Yeah, I could see why Werner Herzog would endure any of the bullshit that comes with having him cast in his movie, because he does a really good job in this role.
Yeah, especially, this role requires someone like that, I think.
I mentioned Aguirre's daughter earlier. There's also Ursua's wife. I forget both of their names. But I really liked how they were there, because they were both dressed so elegantly, both these beautiful looking, you know, women that were just in the midst of this horrible jungle environment that's like just hell-bent on killing them, between just the environment itself and all the Indians and stuff like that and the lack of food. And it's just, I really appreciate that contrast.
Yeah. Well, they're like a carriage that's getting carried through all this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. The sedan chair or whatever they call
it.
But once Ursua is dead, right?
Yeah. He dies eventually. They basically take him out on a canoe and he's like, hey, let's never see him again.
Yeah. She, Ursua's wife, just puts on this beautiful gown and just walks into the forest and is never seen again.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think essentially she was just like probably committing suicide because she knew the Indians would get her. But...
Yeah, like no matter what, she's dying.
Yeah, I thought that was a cool scene. I love that mystery too, because it never, that's the thing about this movie, it never like spells anything out for you.
No.
which I really appreciate.
Yeah, it feels like he made the movie he wanted to make, and kind of audiences be damned. There's the part where the two Indians arrive on the canoe, and they're being, like, you know, peaceful and everything, and it seems like things are going fine. But then when they hand him a Bible and mm-hmm. say, oh, it's the word of God, and they just don't, they're confused by it. And they're just, like, put to death for, like, blasphemy for, like, holding a Bible up and being like, oh, what is this?
You know? Well, he puts it to his ear because he says it's the voice of God or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, and they just kill them immediately.
Yeah, why not? Like, you're these people are watching you at all times in the shadows. You want to be on their good side. Why immediately start with the, you should convert to our religion? Like, yeah. Why not hold off and wait till, like, one drunken night of partying, just be like, hey, you're here with this guy, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, dude's cool. Yeah, why don't you check this out? Here's a book. Yeah. There's also the part where the two guys are kind of recklessly talking about deserting. They're just kind of sitting, like, 10 feet away from Aguirre, who is a maniac, and they're just like, we should totally get away from this fucker. Like, let's get out of here. Mm. And Aguirre is just, like, walking up, and even as he's standing right behind the one dude, they're still talking about it. And he just chops his head clean off.
Isn't it Aguirre's, like, assistant, guy who does the chopping? Like, I feel like that guy does a lot of his dirty work.
Oh, yeah, I think he does do a little kind of, like, head thing, and then gets his head chopped off, and then the head keeps kind of talking for a second. And then at the end, everything just goes right to shit.
Oh my gosh. It's when it gets bad. Like, it's so cool to see how, like, gradually it deteriorates. Like, you really see it step by step get worse and worse and worse. It doesn't, like, jump, like, 5 days later. Like, you see it go from bad to very bad to where this raft is pretty much destroyed. There's just a few people left. They're all starving.
They're sick.
They're sick and delusional because they haven't eaten, and they've been on the river.
The one guy knew he was sick, but, like, drank ink thinking it was medicine because he was just so out of sorts. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so they think they see... the one guy thinks he sees a ship in the trees, and was it Aguirre that's like, oh, no, it's the priest that's like, oh, you're delusional because, of, you know, obviously you haven't been eating. But there really was a ship there. I guess the area would flood. That was the reasoning.
Oh, in the filming of the movie, it was really there, right?
Yes, yes.
Right, right. Like, in the fiction, wasn't it a thing where it was originally supposed to be part of the story and they had the footage, but then it's like the ending or something changed? I read that this is what happened. They filmed it initially to be part of the story. Mm-hmm. And then even when that got changed, they were like, oh, we could work that into them kind of like hallucinating and stuff.
Okay, so it was supposed to be a hallucination.
I think in the fiction of the film, I think that is supposed to not exist there. That's how I took that.
And then this is when this, like, onslaught of arrows come and people just kind of get picked off. And then Aguirre, you know, does his goes to his daughter, and his daughter gets shot, and so
the king
she's
dies.
Dead. Yeah, king's dead. He's essentially claimed power, and he's still hellbound on, you know, being the prince of Peru or whatever. And this horde of monkeys comes on the ship. It's just so cool.
It's so weird.
It's very strange. It's really interesting. It's like all he has to rule now is just the monkeys.
But he's still, like, in his face and the way he talks, you feel like he still believes it. Mm-hmm. He's like, oh, yes, you're my, you know, subjects, and I'm going to lead us to, you know, immortality or gold or whatever. Mm-hmm. While, you know, it just pans out. Like, I love how it was circling around the raft at the end, and it's just a bunch of fucking monkeys on a sinking raft with a crazy person talking about how everything's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, this is a bleak ending.
Completely futile.
Just so bleak.
Yeah, very bleak.
I was really into that.
It was awesome. Like I said, going into this movie, I had no idea what it would be like. I didn't know it would be so singularly focused on this journey and nothing outside of the journey. And I really liked that.
Yeah. I also read that it was a shot on a camera that Werner Herzog stole from film school. And he's got some quotes about why that was okay. And he's like, well, no, the artist needs a camera to make his films. And, like, if you were stuck in a room with no air, you would bust through a wall for air, and that's fine. Like, it's the same way I stole the camera.
Was it the camera or the film?
I think it was the camera that I read.
I don't think the film school would mind.
Oh, yeah, it's Werner Herzog. But also the monkeys, he got those because he was at an airport, and there was, like, some sort of delivery for, like, 400 monkeys. I don't know how that works at all. But he, like, convinced them that he would need to get them, like, tested, or they were bringing them in. Like, he basically lied about, like, oh, we need to bring them in for this thing before they could be shipped or whatever, and stole all 400 monkeys, used them for the film, and then released them into the wild.
I thought what happened was he paid people to trap the monkeys. They did. And then some buyer from Los Angeles or whatever came and was like, okay, I'm going to take these monkeys instead. And then Werner Herzog was there, was like, oh, no, I have to do these tests first.
That sounds right.
So the guys gave it to him, and, you know, he stole them and then released them to the wild. But yeah, yeah, there's a lot of interesting anecdotes about the production of this movie. The audio track is really interesting. So, like, none of the audio we hear them speaking German, at least in the Criterion channel version that we watched. But they actually filmed it speaking, all the actors were speaking English. But, I mean, naturally, it was filming in the Amazon. They filmed on location. The audio would be tough to hear. So they replaced that with another English track, you know, they ADR'd it. They couldn't get Klaus Kinski to, you know, redo his lines because it would cost too much money. Whoever was doing the synchronization didn't do a good job. So, they scrapped that and did a German audio version. That's the version that we hear today. So
that's so interesting thinking that there is like a English track of that that exists out there.
Yeah, I don't know. It might be accessible somehow. I'm not sure. I didn't know if it's like completely destroyed, like unhearable, unlistenable, unfindable, but or if it's just something that's not as commonly found as the German version.
Yeah, I'll say even if it wasn't the original voices and it was like this like triple dub type thing or whatever, it didn't bother me at all.
No, you know, there really wasn't a ton of dialogue in the movie, so it wasn't that distracting at all.
A lot of atmosphere, not a ton of dialogue, really. Also, it sounds like Herzog wrote it on a bus trip with the soccer team, and there were like several pages that like one of his drunk teammates puked on. He just threw them out the window, and in like interviews, he's like, I don't even remember what was on those pages, so he just threw them out. It's like, that's not in the movie anymore. But, yeah, I mean, just a cool, weird movie.
It was great. I mean, I could see why it's as, you know, considered a landmark piece as it is, because it's a great experience. Yeah. Really cool. I didn't know what to expect. It has some of those trademarks of, like, older movies, like movies from the 70s, especially, where it just lets things breathe.
Yeah.
Like, it's just almost like slice of life kind of, like I said earlier, just very matter-of-fact presentation,
but in a way that works, because I think you can overdo that, like, you know, we talked about before about Solaris when we tried to watch that, and it's like, yeah, that lets some stuff breathe, but like that was like too much. It's like we're just watching a highway.
I know what you're saying, but I think with Solaris it was letting stuff breathe. It wasn't so much letting stuff breathe as it was staying with something for a really long time for artistic purposes. Like it wasn't to portray the realism. It was more just to, like, let's stay with this because this, you know, the road through Tokyo, these highways through Tokyo or whatever they were driving through parallels, you know, makes some parallel to the guy's mental state or something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't think it was necessarily meant to be like a realistic presentation.
Yeah, and I felt like I wasn't getting anything about those long shots in Solaris, but like the horse scene they hold on for a while, like that was like a weirdly haunting scene. Like I felt like haunting. That was like, oh, I'm glad they're holding on this. This is cool.
Yeah, it was awesome. I highly recommend the movie.
Yeah, and it's one of those.
Of course, I highly recommend Werner Herzog's Aguirre, yes. Wrath of God.
It's one of those great examples, though, of a movie that like we probably would have never seen if we didn't do this podcast, and you know, us wanting to kind of stretch out and try stuff we normally wouldn't. So I'm really glad we do that.
Yeah, that's great.
Let's keep doing it.
Totally.
Yes. So that'll be it for this week on Painting the Stream. We want to give a special shout out to all of our patrons on patreon.com/panningthestream.
Thank you.
Shout out. We thank you for your $5 a month, our one tier that we offer. That gets you an ad-free version of the podcast each and every week. One ad-free version. You also get a day early on the episodes.
Whoa.
That's right. That's the proper reaction. You get it on a Saturday instead of a Sunday. I put it up early in the morning for you folks on Saturday. And then also, you also get a Bonku written, especially for you. By the way, that's how she always like cheers or expresses surprise. It's just that. Every time we go to a fireworks display, it's just you. Just whoa. Turn into a Muppet. Do we have a Bonku for a new patron this week?
We sure do, Dan.
What do we got, Bonk?
This week's Bonku is for our friend Scott. Scott is a great guy.
Hey, Scott.
I think he's special in a lot of ways. Scott, ask your mom about that. She'll be happy to tell you what a special guy you are. But just in case the people at home don't know, I wrote this Bonku for Scott so that they may get some insight into what makes Scott so great.
No.
It is natural to feel joy in his presence. Scott is just that way.
Oh, wow. You know what? A lot of the Bonkus, there's a dark mystery to them. This is just pleasant.
Yeah,
Scott's just a solid dude.
It must be the Animal Crossing making an effect on you, and everything's just nice and positive. Well, thanks, Scott, and thanks, Bonk, for that excellent Bonk coup.
Of course.
Yeah. So, thanks to Scott, all the patrons, all the listeners. If you want to email us and give us any comments, suggestions, anything, it's panningthestream@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter @panthestream. If you can give us the 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, that really does help us out quite a bit.
That would be awesome!
That would be great. That would make her go, whoa, 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 whoa.
Whoa, 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 whoa.
There you go. You'll get more of that. Tom Monda, thanks for the theme song. Great as always.
Thank you, bro.
And that's it for this week. Bonk. Thank you, most of all.
Thank you, Dan.
Joining me each and every week. We'll be back next week with more Painting the Stream.
Bye.